The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. The ACOI-ACOS keynote presentation, My Life Was Saved by Osteopathic Care, is presented by Mr. Vance Johnson.
Good morning. I'm a little nervous. I'll put this here. I am a little bit nervous. And it's not necessarily because of all the people that are here. Well, let's start back. 2 days ago, I had to go see a urologist. And about 10 months ago, I saw him. But 2 days ago, I saw this urologist, and I told him, you know, I know this is kind of right before the year where I have a checkup, so is there any way you can kind of hold off on on this procedure that we're going to go through? And he told me, well, I said, because I'm going to speak before some DOs, and, you know, they actually care about me. You're just a regular doctor. And so he said, and he was just busy click, 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 asking me these questions. And he said, so what you're telling me is you're not going to be able to go and speak? I say, sir, can you at least, like, touch me, talk to me a little bit? Or are you just going to just stick it right in? So I had to go in there and pee in the cup. And then he told me to hop up on the bed. And next thing you know, he was on his way. So I'm a little traumatized this morning, as you can see. All right, I have so much and I'm so overwhelmed. I'm married and now I know how my wife feels when she's overwhelmed, because men can generally just focus on one thing and just stay there. But my wife, she just gets consumed with everything and she's like talking about all this. I'm like, honey, how do you do that? Now I know, so here I am. So I've got a couple cheat notes up here, so I can talk a little bit about who I am. And on this first slide, I will tell you who I am now, but no one told me how to use this, so I'm gonna push a button and hopefully it's gonna work. There it is. My name is Vance Johnson. I am a former Denver Bronco. Played for 10 years with the great John Elway. Any Bronco fans here? I know one flew in town. We got a few Bronco fans here. Yeah, played for 10 years with the great John Elway. Just had an amazing time playing with him. What a great leader. I'm sure you have great leaders here too, because whether it's work or whether it's play, whether it's fun, there's always going to be a leader and everyone's going to follow that leader. I followed John Elway, and some of the games and some of the memories that I have now that I'm 4 years sober, when I think about it and I look back, I can understand why we have these trials and tribulations in life. I was an alternate on the Olympic team in 1984. I was actually on the team until the last jump of the night. We were inside the Coliseum there in Los Angeles, and there was one last jumper, the last event, and so there was probably about 100,000 people inside the stadium cheering for this one guy. And I was already celebrating because I was on the team. And all of a sudden, when I heard everyone clapping and watching this one guy, I said, oh my gosh, he's gonna beat me. And he ended up beating me by about a quarter of an inch. And so I was the alternate on the team. But that was one of the highlights of my life too. I am currently an outreach coordinator for Futures of Palm Beach in Tequesta, Florida, about 10 minutes away from Tiger Woods' house. We're a full inpatient facility. Detox, everything, and just an amazing group of people that I work with there. The owner is out of Newtown Square, Pennsylvania, and they had some family issues about 4 or 5 years ago and didn't feel like, because of the different facilities he visited around the country, that it was a place that he wanted to send his family members. And so he decided to do it himself and then just really put together the best team. After vetting, they brought me aboard as a spokesperson, where I'm an outreach coordinator, manager up in the Northeast. I work the D.C., Maryland, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania area, and I find myself just running around trying to save as many people as possible by offering them hope that you can actually come back from this death that's trying to kill you in addiction. I live now, as of today, I'll be moving across the river into Pennsylvania because I couldn't afford it over in New Jersey. So I was living in the Princeton, West Windsor area, and they make you pay for wherever you send your kids to school at, and so I couldn't afford to stay in that area. So we went across the bridge, and now we're going to have less taxes and still be able to work in New Jersey proper. Let me go to this next thing. I want to thank the American College of Osteopathic Internists and a number of people that are here that invited me to come and share my journey, my story. It's going to be a little different this morning because I'm just going to kind of be the wake-up person. I'm going to be that patient that gets to come to the office and tell you my story so you can decide what it is that's going to be best for me so that I can live a long, healthy life. I want to thank one person in particular, and I kind of wanted to wait until the event started, but he's here this morning. I haven't had a chance to see him since I've been sober. Since I left Denver, Colorado, 4 years ago, a few days ago. And Dr. Mark Twardowski, DO, is here. I can't wait to tell you the story, how I realized who he was. So when I was asked to speak there in New Jersey, at the event that they had there in Atlantic City, I didn't understand why they wanted me to speak, but I know it's about the opioids, but what was the picture? How did I fit with what they wanted to hear me talk about? And they started to describe what an osteopathic surgeon is, what a DO is. And they started to describe this person, and I said, wait a second, that sounds like the doctor that saved my life. And so I said, what? His name was Mark Twardowski. And so I ended up going to my Google, and I saw his name, and I looked, and it said DO. And I dropped my phone, and I just started to cry. And I realized that was the man that saved my life. So that's the difference? That's what a DO is? They actually care about you. Now I'm going to back up and tell you where I come from. I'm originally from Trenton, New Jersey. Anybody know where that is? My father actually, oh, we got some clappers. Okay, good place to be from, right? My father actually grew up in New Jersey, and he was a gangbanger. He ran the streets, and he ran numbers. His father died when he was really young. I think he was around 8 or 9 years old when his father passed away. He worked the railroad tracks. And my dad got in a lot of trouble running with gangs, using drugs, alcohol, chasing women, just a number of things. Eventually, most of the gang members were getting killed off, and he ended up in court because he was facing a lot of jail time. So he was told, you're either going to take these couple of options or you're going to end up dead. You're going to end up in jail, and you can go to jail now because of all the things you've done, young man. Most of the members in your gang are dead. Your other option is you can join the service. My father opted to join the service. So my dad was stationed down in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, down in Tucson, Arizona. They called it Fort Uchicuchi. I don't know where that came from, but that's what he told me they called it. And being stationed down there, he spent about 4 years in the service. But during his time down there, he was able to go out and have a good time, and he ended up going to a party. Anybody remember the singer named James Brown? Lots of people. Everyone's getting close to my age up here. So my father went to this James Brown concert where he saw this young lady who was sitting inside of a car. And he tapped on the window. And see, back then, they didn't have buttons to push, so she had to wind it down like this. And he introduced himself and said, my name is Eugene. She said, my name is Imogene. And he asked, why aren't you in the party? And well, she said, I would be in the party, but my boyfriend's in there. I'm not old enough. I'm only 15 years old. My dad was 21. I tell the high school kids, don't practice this one, young ladies. So he talks to the young lady for about 3 or 4 hours during the party, and eventually he gets her phone number, and so he starts to visit her out in Marana, Arizona, where she lived at. Now, my mother at the time, a sophomore in high school, she picked cotton for a living for 16 cents a day. So my dad, after getting a chance to court this young lady and going out to the cotton gin yard to see her once in a while, he decided that he was going to propose to this young virgin. So he went to her high school at Marana High School. She was a sophomore, walked across the stage and got on his knees and proposed to her. And she said, I'll marry you, but you have to ask my daddy. So they go back out to the cotton gin yard where my grandfather was the foreman. And he said, yes, you can marry my young daughter. So they catch an airplane and they head back out here to New Jersey because my father now gets a chance to dodge the draft because my mom's pregnant. So they're in Trenton, New Jersey, and then that's where I was born, Trenton, New Jersey. As a young child, you know, I heard my father start to run the streets again back in New Jersey. He started to do the same old things. He started to run numbers. He started to drink a lot. He started to use drugs. He started to hang out with his old friends, the ones that were left. And the other things he started to do was beat on my mother. And my mom now, what, 16 and a half years old, decided she couldn't really deal with this. And so she takes this young son of hers and she goes out to Tucson, Arizona and leaves my dad. My dad gets a hold of her and says, I really want to be with you. And she says, well, I'm having a hard time living there in Jersey and you're treating me really bad. But, you know, he comes back out and grabs her and me and comes back again to New Jersey. About 9 months later, my sister was born. Now, nothing really changed, though, because my father kept running the streets. He kept drinking. My mom would tell me the stories about driving across the bridge over into PA to pick him up with his friends. And she's only, what, 6, 17, 18 years old now. But she's still getting beat on. So she takes my sister and I for the last time and gets on the train and heads back out to Tucson, Arizona, and says, if you want to be with us, you're going to have to come to Arizona to be with us. Because I can't handle what you're putting me through out there with these children in Trenton, New Jersey. My dad decides that he wants to be with his family, and so he comes out to Arizona to live with us and gets a job at Mountain Bell. But he doesn't stop putting his hands on my mother. I'm old enough now where I'm starting to witness these things and see from my own eyes the trauma that my mother's going through. I remember being in the back of a Buick, didn't have any brakes, and my sister and I would be sitting there, and I watched my mother and my father arguing, and my father would reach over and just smack my mother in the face, and I see blood go up against the windshield. My sister and I would be in the back of the car just crying. At nighttime, I see my mother always on her knees and praying out to this God that she believed in. And I see a father coming home happy from being drunk every night. I see a father coming home with lipstick on his collar. And I hear the arguments and the fighting. And I just didn't understand it, but this was the dynamic that I saw when I was a child. When I was young, they didn't have the dollar store buckets, but they had the little metal buckets that you mop out of. My dad would come home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He'd be hungry, so my mother would warm up some mashed potatoes. And all of a sudden, I saw that metal bucket go over top of my mom's head. I'm crying. My sister's crying. They tell us to go in the room so we don't know what's going on, but we know what's going on. And I find out my dad doesn't like lumpy potatoes, and that's the reason why that happened. This is what addiction did to my family as a child. So my only escape, I think this works. How did I make that go forward? So my only escape was sports. As a young kid in elementary school, I started to just run a lot. When I was at home, I just ran a lot. I ran so much that I would get so tired that I would end up just passing out. And I got really good at running because there was a lot of domestic abuse happening in my home. Everything that I said I would never be when I grew up because I did not like seeing my mother on her knees crying and praying out to this God and a father coming home drunk every night and putting his hands on my mother. But still being functional and getting up at 4:30 in the morning and going to work all day. I didn't understand it, but I knew I didn't want to be like that growing up. I got so good at it that when I went to elementary school and I went to junior high school, the teachers, they kind of noticed that something was going on with this kid. And so they took me under their wings. You know, we don't tell, especially out of New Jersey, we don't tell people what's happening in our own home. They knew something was happening, though, because I was kind of quiet and kind of reserved. And I always wanted to be involved with sports. Plus, I was kind of uncontrollable when it came to this ADHD thing, I guess now is what they call it. They didn't call it back then that. So running was my escape. I was that hero growing up as a child because what I noticed as I started to grow that there was actually less domestic violence whenever I did really well in sports. Whenever I made more touchdowns, the violence would be less. Eventually, when I got to high school, I got really, really good. I was able to represent the United States of America in the Pan American Games over in South America, and I won the long jump there. My dad was really proud of me. He'd come to the football game and he'd tell me that he'd be drunk on the sidelines. I want 5 touchdowns. I'd score 5 touchdowns. Whatever it took, I just still wanted to make him proud. I wanted to make this mother who I always saw praying proud as well. As time went on, I had a chance to start to date. But I didn't want to be like my father, and so I didn't know how to be in a relationship. Yeah, I watched all the shows that we watched when we were children, My Three Sons, I Dream of Jeannie. And so I had about 15 minutes to half an hour learning how to be nice to people, but outside of that, I didn't know how to have a girlfriend. I got to the point where I promised myself when I got older, this is when I was 15 years old, that I was going to cut off my penis. As time went on, and just really giving myself to the sport and realizing that I had a future and this is the way that I can get out of this hell that I'm growing up in and around, I was offered a chance to go to college at the University of Arizona. I stayed home. I wanted to stay close to mom because I knew the violence was pretty crazy. Now, in college, my first year in college, I had a game against UCLA. That's right, we played against UCLA, the opening kickoff. I was fifth team going in, but for some reason, the first team guy actually was ineligible. The second, third team guy couldn't catch, and we were going to have a third, a throwing game. And the fourth team guy, he actually couldn't catch. And so I ended up going in as a starter. First play of the game was the opening kickoff. I ran it back for a 99-yard touchdown. So that was kind of the beginning of my career. Also, as a freshman in college, NCAA championship, I went in long jump. I'm the 15th alternate, I'm sorry, the 15th player to get into the finals for the final day, the 15th athlete. So I'm on my knees just praying that night, just asking God, give me a chance to just go out there and I'm going to jump one for you, Lord. So I go out there. Carl Lewis is in the lead. I'm in 15th place. I get a chance to get up and jump now. I'm running down the runway. I do my little penultimate right before the board. In fact, I was like 6 to 12 inches behind the board. I jump, and for some reason, I was still in the air when I thought I was going to come down. I ended up winning the NCAA championship long jump with 27-11 and 3/4. I was actually almost 29 feet where I jumped from. So I was pretty excited about that. Going back home, being that hero, I really thought that domestic violence would start to slow down, but it still was a little crazy. And so what I decided to do was go to my parents' house and tell my father to come outside because I was going to F and kill him. And I told him, if you ever put your hands on my mother again, I'm going to kill you. And he was drunk. And he told me, oh, don't worry, I'm not going to touch your mom. Why don't you just kill me? Now, the abuse continued, but mainly verbal. So now it's draft time. I'm one of the fastest in college, NCAA champion, had a great career in college. I get a call on draft day from the Los Angeles Raiders. Al Davis is in the background. Ask him if he wants to be a Raider. I didn't want to be a Raider. The other line rang. They said, hello, this is the Denver Broncos, and we're going to be moving up above the Raiders and draft you. So I just hung up the phone on the Raiders. And I ended up being drafted in the second round by the Denver Broncos. When I fly out to Denver, Colorado, by this time in my life, I had not had a drink, not a drug, nothing. Because there was no way I was going to be anything like what I saw growing up. Now I had a chance to go be great. Now I had a chance to be different from everything that I saw, everything that I hated as a child. On the airplane, we flew out to Denver, Colorado. And I land, and the newspapers, when I get off the airplane, say, Broncos advance. That was like the happiest day of my life. To this moment, I'm just so proud about that. The first game of my career was against the San Francisco 49ers, and it was in a preseason game. And all I had to do was go out there at the end of the game. They were going to get me out there, get my feet wet to catch a punt. So I could catch a punt with my eyes closed or sometimes even with one hand. So I'm standing on the 10-yard line, and we're playing in Candlestick Stadium. Anyone ever been there? Oh my goodness, the wind blows around like crazy inside Candlestick Stadium. Well, the ball's in the air, and I'm looking at the ball, and I'm on the 10-yard line, and the ball's coming, looks like it's a little short, so I'm running forward towards it. Then all of a sudden, the ball's going backwards, and I run back, and I look down towards the 10. I put my hands up to do a fair catch, but the ball hits my hand, rolls in the end zone. San Francisco scores a touchdown and wins the ball game. My teammates are all looking at me like, dude, your career is over with. I was so sad that I remember on the airplane, I was so worried because I knew I was going to get cut the next day, that when they picked me up in the morning, I was like, I'm so worried, guys, because this was like my whole life, all I ever wanted to do. What's going to happen to me now? They said, well, you're probably going to get cut, man. So, well, let's just stop by the liquor store. No, I don't drink. They said, come on, just one shot of tequila. So they stopped by the liquor store, and I do a shot of tequila, and I'm like, whoa. So you're telling me that all I have to do is just a little bit of this? So I could have been doing this my whole life to get rid of that stress and anxiety I was dealing with? Just one shot of tequila? Well, then what I started to do was, when they started introducing opioids, they started introducing all different types of pills so that I can wake up and so I can be strong on the football field. They started giving me shots. And when I mixed alcohol along with the pills, I had a great time. I enjoyed life. I was able to cope and deal with everything that was happening to me. I actually started dating. I got some nerve up. I started dating this young girl that I met out at a nightclub. She gave me her phone number. I actually went out again another night, threw it in the trash, but I realized to do it in the trash, went back to the bar that I went to, jumped over the fence. By the way, I still haven't really got real deep into the drinking yet. Jumped over the fence, got her phone number back, called her. We start dating a little bit. She gives me a call about 6 or 7 months later and says I'm pregnant. I'm in Houston, Texas, and I'm going to have an abortion. And I'm begging her, please don't kill this baby, because my family, we don't believe in killing babies. I said, I'll marry you. So I get on an airplane out to Houston, Texas, after drinking a bottle of tequila, dropped a couple Xanax. We fly out to Las Vegas, and we get married for $12 through a drive-thru. Not too much longer, my son Vaughn was born. So one day I'm at practice, and I'm in the shower with about 60 other guys, and one of the guys says, I get stuck here because this is how transparency is just freedom for me. One of the guys says to me, how's our girl Ange? And I'm like, who? And then another guy says, yeah, I know Ange. She's a big freak. That was my wife. My wife had been cheating on me with my teammates. I was so angry that I ran home and I ran upstairs and I'm screaming and yelling and I'm throwing things. I took a couple pills. I'm drinking. I'm yelling, I'm knocking the television set off the wall, and I run up to her, and I ask her if it's true, and I'm screaming, if it's true, is it true? Because they knew this, and they knew this, and they knew this, and I pushed her across the bed, and she flew across the bed and hit her head on the door. I thought she was dead. I dragged her to the bathroom, and I started to try to dump water on her face so I can bring her to. And after she came to, I was still angry. I was still mad about what she had done to me. Now, my father, my mother didn't deserve that. He should have been doing that to my mother. But this young lady, she cheated on me, so she deserves anything she gets. And so now I just really want to do everything to hurt everyone that's ever hurt me in my life. And so I drink, I use, I'm still a great football player. I date anyone I want to date. I have sex with anyone I want to have sex with. I get a divorce from her, and I get married again. So here I am now with 2 children. I get married again. I leave her for another person. By the way, everything I'm doing now, I'm using, obviously. Because decisions just are made off my emotions after I have these pills and this alcohol in me. I leave her, I marry somebody else. I leave that person, I marry somebody else. Because I don't know how to function within a relationship. Like I said, I remember as a child watching the 15 to 30 minutes, so I knew how to charm someone for a little while. Enough time to have them make a commitment to me for marriage and have sex with me. I created this world for myself. In fact, I came up with this name, The Vance. Being married during my NFL career 4 different times. Drinking, on the way to the game, drunk, hoping that I would sober up in time, take a couple pills so I could pick myself up when I play. I wanted to be great. I wanted to make my father proud and my mother proud. I let the young ladies drop my children off at the ball game. They come across the fence. There's 70, 80,000 people in the stands, and my kids right before the game are running up and down the field. Everyone's like, oh, look at Vance Johnson. He's such a great dad. His children are having such fun out there. I hand them back across the fence. They go back with their moms. I paid my child support whenever I had the money after spending it on myself for drugs. I thought I was a good person. I went to the Super Bowl. It was the most I ended up going to the Super Bowl. I was standing on the sideline. I remember the national anthem came. And I stood there, and I was so proud to be an American at the time. I was so excited. I remember when I was 7 years old, standing on the sideline listening to the national anthem. It was like the best feeling in the world. And I was so excited to play in this game. And while I'm stuck on that, I have to cut the story off so I can say something. I spoke out against my brothers in the NFL for taking a knee. I was very verbal about it, too, because I didn't understand what that was all about. They don't know that these brothers and sisters who gave their lives up were wrapped in flags and flown back to our country. Ever since I was a child, I just stood there and just honored our flag. I honored what the men and women did, so that we can have freedom in this country to do whatever we want to do, even take a knee, to protest, whatever we want to do, but not against our flag, not against what we represent to the world. I got to get off that because I'll talk for the next hour about that. I'm sorry. Okay. As time went on through my career, I just really felt like, you know, I'm a Christian. I'm pointing up at the sky. I'm the guy pointing at the sky, worshiping God, going to church. But just only because I want the pastor to recognize that I'm there, because there's about 600 or 700 people in the audience. I give a little bit of money to the church. I go up to the front to the altar call. I get baptized. I'm worshiping God. I'm better than my father. But I'm getting married over and over again. I try to commit suicide twice during my career. I'm sitting in the closet after a Super Bowl because I'm like, is this all there is? So I'm trying to cut my wrist, and all of a sudden the phone rings and it's my mother. Two different times that happened to me. Even though she's a domineering person now at this point in my life and controlling everything that happens in my life, she's actually a part of the reason why I couldn't be in relationships too, because she would tell me not to be with a certain person, or she would call the lady and say, don't be with my son. So all this will kind of come to a culmination when I talk to you about the rest of my life. As time went on, I got out of the NFL. I moved to the western slope of Colorado. I was offered a chance to have a mortgage company. I was kind of starting my life all over again, but I was still using drugs and alcohol, getting married again. But this time, when I move over to the western slope of Colorado, I'm already married 6 times. Opening up my own restaurant, have a Porsche driving $150,000 vehicles. I'm so excited because now I'm going to church and I'm a different person. I'm still using, but I'm kind of using casually. Eventually, my oldest son now decides he wants to come over and spend some time with Dad because he loves me and he wants to be with his father. So relationships are starting to be restored a little bit. My son comes over. He's working with me at the restaurant. I buy him a house. He has a motorcycle and a car. He ends up trying to get a hold of me because he needed to head across the mountain to go see his mother, who his grandfather just died of cancer, so he wanted to go see his mother. My son takes his motorcycle because he couldn't reach me to borrow my car. I don't know how to... Okay, I'm not working now. There we go. My son ends up going to give his girlfriend a kiss goodnight, and he's heading home to go see his mother, have dinner with her, and he gets run over and killed by a drunk driver. I get a call at 10:30 in the morning. I'm behind my bar at my restaurant and I'm drinking. I hear what happened to my son, the light of my life. And so what I decided to do was just start drinking and using so I could cope again. So for the next 2 years, I drank and used and chased women, and I ended up using myself into a coma. Everything started shutting down inside of me. So for 28 days in this induced coma, they asked my family members to come and say their goodbyes because they didn't know how much longer afterwards I was going to live. My sister took this deathbed picture of me, and I wish I'd had this on there, but I don't have it, so forgive me for that. I show it to everyone else I speak to, but for some reason I didn't have up here today. When I got out of that bed, actually, when I was in the bed and chained, I remember waking up, and I had this tube hanging out of me to urinate. I'm chained to the bed. I have to call and scream out for the lady to come in, and they take me off the chains and roll me over and clean the poop off of me from my head to my toes. And I'm laying in the bed like, really, God, this is how it's going to end for me? This is how this career ended? When I got up, I ended up going to my parents' house because by this time now I was leaving my then 7th wife. I'm moving to Mom and Dad's house, who are still married. I live in their back bedroom. I'm just drinking vodka. I'm taking pills. I'm doing everything. I stayed kind of functional in it for a little while, and it started getting so bad that they told me that I could go see this doctor. I didn't want to go see him. I ended up going out on a date. I'm on a date. I go home, I'm fixing some wine for us, and I go and I open up the dishwasher and I grab this glass and I'm cleaning it off, and the glass snaps and it sticks all the way into my arm, all the way to the bone. I pull it out. And after a while, I started to turn a little gray, and this young lady takes me to the hospital. And I'm in the hospital and I fill out the paperwork and they tell me to go sit over there, and all of a sudden, this doctor walks out and sees me. And he notices that I'm falling over, and so they end up putting me on a gurney, I think it's called, and they push me in the back room. And he's talking to me about my arm and this carpal tunnel syndrome, is that what it's called? And so he says, I don't know if you're going to have a hand when you wake up, because this is pretty serious. So I have a scar from here to here. That was Dr. Mark Twardowski, the first time I met him. He spoke with me a little bit and told me he wanted to see me again. I said, I don't have any insurance. He said, that's okay. I want you to come and see me. He started to spend time with me. He started to talk to me about my life and about my childhood, about my mother and about my father. He asked so many questions, and I was like, why is this guy asking me questions? I just need to figure out how to get some blood pressure medication. But he's doing all these different things to just learn more and more about me so he can treat my symptoms. But it all was because of the different things that have gone on in my life, obviously. And, he started to tell me, Vance, I'll tell you, I know you have this issue with the drinking. By the way, are you having problems having sex? I'm like, can I get some blood pressure pills? Can I get some opioids? He didn't want to give me anything except for whatever it was going to take to just to keep me healthy so that eventually I was going to be able to hear what he's having to say. And he kept me healthy. Obviously, I kept drinking, but I kept going back to him because I knew he would listen to me. He kept treating the symptoms, mind, body, soul, and spirit. He was treating the man, not just click, 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 and offer me something so that I can get out of my head. He took care of me. And again, I didn't know who this guy was at the time, but I wanted to just keep in seeing him. He did so many procedures to keep me alive. Finally, I'm driving through this canyon, and I'm just crying out to God. Lord, I just really got to get some help. I don't know what to do. I can't beat this on my own. I go back and see the doctor again, and he tells me, I know someone like you who worked so hard to get through everything you've gone through in life when you were a child, everything you did when you made it to the NFL, the strength and the power it must have took and the mind control and everything, that you can get past this thing, you can beat this thing. And he was the only one that was giving me that voice because I was not on the football field anymore. I wasn't around old teammates anymore. I was isolated in a small community on the western slope of Colorado. And so he was my coach. And eventually, by the grace of God, I woke up one morning and I knew what this man had told me. And I knew if this God was real, that there was grace and mercy on my life, that I needed to do something about it. My then seventh ex-wife had reached out to the NFL and they talked to Randy Grimes, another former pro football player that was in recovery. And he said, why don't you come on down to Florida and get some help? I said, I'm coming. So knowing where I was going, I actually start taking pictures saying that I'm going to rehab. I was telling everyone, I'm going to rehab. I got on the airplane. I started telling everyone where I was going. When I got out to Florida, I checked into this 28-day facility that the NFL would pay for only 28 days. I remember when I first got there, I was around a whole bunch of drug addicts, alcoholics, and crackheads. I'm like, they're not like me. Where are the football players at? I want to be on the beach drinking virgin pina coladas and watching girls play volleyball. And then I'm looking across the street, not wanting to go be a part of the community, and I realized when I looked up and saw this cross on this big stadium, and I heard this voice say, Vance, you're sick and you have to get help. And I walked back in there, and I got so engaged, and I started listening to the stories of the other men that were in there. And I started paralleling my story with them, and I started understanding there are a lot of underlying issues that we were dealing with. And so I started to get educated on addiction. And I realized if it took this long to get to this place, there was no way in the world that I would be sober if I left here for a lifetime unless I continued this journey. And then I stood out in the ocean. They took us to the ocean. I stood there for 2 hours. And I looked out over the Atlantic horizon. And I said, what is behind me, I'm never going back to again. And so when I left this facility, I went back home to Colorado. And I didn't want to be there because I was around people, places, and things, and I was famous there. My teammates would call me and ask me to come to a game or come to a party, and I said, I can't go. My mother fires me from my own restaurant because the people know that I don't drink. They want to keep me away from it. I ended up getting a call to go work at the facility that I got sober at. They offered me $15 an hour part-time and a bus pass, so about $240 a week. I took it. Right before I left, the Friday before the Monday I was supposed to take off, the Denver Broncos called me and said, we can't pay you much, but we'll pay you a couple $1,000 a week just to be you. $200 a week, $2,000 a week. The devil's subtle. I called my mother. She said, son, I know you're going to do the right thing. I get on an airplane on Monday, and I go back to Florida, and I'm catching a bus to work every day I don't have a pot to piss in. I have no money. But I'm around the people that are like me who are wanting a lifetime of sobriety. And all I am is a ball boy. They couldn't keep enough therapists on the weekends, and so they asked me, Vance, can you handle the class? And so I sat there with 100 guys for the next year, every Saturday and Sunday, and just talked about life and about recovery and about underlying issues and about learning about this addiction and how they can beat it and about my story and about my near-death experiences, about all the relationships and the marriages. Whatever they had, they could throw at me because I've already been through it. Then I was offered a chance to move back to New Jersey, the place where I came from. This next Tuesday, I have a meeting with Governor Christie to talk about what I want to do in New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, for the people who don't have insurance, for the people who need help, for the people who need to have hope, to build communities back up. Because this addiction, this disease has just covered our country now. And that's why I'm excited about being here talking with all of you. Because I'm looking at Mark Twardowski times 1,500. That's who you are. You are set apart and different. Something made you choose this career in your life. Ultimately, God led you to this. Every bad thing that's ever happened to you was a good thing. It was a lesson to be learned. It was a road to cross so that you can get here. I'm looking at Mark Twardowski. There's so many lives that you're going to save out there because of who you are and what you do and your specialty. Because you want to put your hands on us. Because you want to know the person inside. So that you can treat this body. You're the difference. And I don't know if you're believers out there or not, but there's an enemy out there if there's good, and it's going to try to destroy you, and it's going to try to even break up this organization. And what I'm hearing is you all need to start actually giving even more to who you are and what you represent as DOs. And so I would encourage all of you to sow more seed into this organization so it will continue to grow. And look for people like myself, sports athletes, or whoever the community, the college kids are going to say you should be a DO. Because there's something special about you. You've lived life experiences. That's the reason why you are who you are today. And that's the reason why Mark Twardowski, sir, will you please stand up, please? I love you so much. This man right here. This man right here is the man who saved my life. And that's the reason why I'm here today. Did you know that what happened to me back then was so that I could be here today, standing in front of all of you and telling you thank you for who you are and what you do to change this country? Thank you for taking a chance and stepping across the line. Thank you for being here and empowering each other. Thank you for what you're about to do. Thank you for sowing seed back into this great organization so more people can hear about it. Because I wish I had a microphone in front of the president. And if I ever get in front of the president, I'm going to tell him we need some more DOs in the world. I'll tell you that for sure. With that said, I know I rambled quite a bit today. And it was a real honor to be here. And like I said, I was a little bit nervous, but I wanted to be here to be able to say thank you to Dr. Twardowski, to be able to share my journey with all of you so you can see the patient come to you and say thanks for all you do, and please go save another one and another one and another one. God bless you. Thank you so much.